While war continues to rage in Ukraine, we want to remain focused on things at home. As such, on today's program, we're going to take a closer look at a few bills currently before Parliament. I'm Matt Halleck, he's Andrew DiBartolo, and you are listening to Liberty Dispatch.
Ladies and gentlemen, we may be approaching a fateful hour.
Bonhoeffer spoke by radio to a national audience. He delivered one of the first public criticisms of the new chancellor.
Never give in. Never, never, never. In nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in except to convictions of honor and good sense.
Welcome, everybody, to Liberty Dispatch, broadcasting across enemy lines into the Canadian culture war. Perhaps you are wondering, who are these two handsome gentlemen before you today? And as we said off the top of the episode, my name is Matthew Halleck. Across the computer screen from me is Andrew DiBartolo. And we are filling in for our brothers, Michael Thiessen and Tim Tyso, as they are both away this week. So you are stuck with us, but it's good to talk with you again, Andrew.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good to be here. Last time we chatted, it was a great discussion about what's happened at the trucker convoy. And so I look forward to talking about what's going on in our country today.
Whether you're watching Rumble, our Rumble channel at Liberty Coalition Canada, or our YouTube channel at Liberty C Canada, or just listening via podcast, please subscribe wherever you get the show. And if you can, leave a 5-star review or a thumbs up, a like, whatever. It really helps us get the show out to more people. And finally, don't forget to subscribe to our contact list at libertycoalitioncanada.com, our website where you can check out all things Liberty Coalition. That way you will not be able to get censored, as YouTube is so wont to do especially, and you can stay up to date on all things LCC. But with housekeeping out of the way, Andrew, it's time to get into the meat and potatoes of the episode that we want to talk to people about today. And while war rages in the Ukraine, and so much of the media attention is glared and trained on what's happening overseas, we didn't want to get lost in the smoke and mirrors of this cycle of reflexivity. And we wanted to, you know, remain laser focused on what's going on here at home. While tyrants abroad rattle their sabers, I don't want us to forget about the would-be dictators at home who continue to try and forward their progressive utopian pipe dreams. And for that reason, I wanted to take a look at some of the current legislation before the 44th Parliament in its first session right now. So, Andrew, of all the insane bills, of which there are many, I thought, which ones stood out to you? And maybe we can discuss some of that.
Well, the particular piece of legislation that I wanted to focus on, and actually you suggested it to me, and I thought, this looks good. This looks like something we need to highlight. And we need to highlight it because it's one of great importance. And as such, I believe it deserves to be handled with the seriousness and the sobriety that it deserves. And so what I want to do is I want to read the preamble and the substance of the bill. This is Bill C-226. Preamble. Whereas our world is in peril, whereas Gaia, the spirit of the earth, can no longer stand the terrible destruction plaguing our planet, whereas she has sent 5 magic rings to 5 special young people, Kwame, Wheeler, Linka, Guy, and Mati, and whereas when the 5 powers combine, they summon Earth's greatest champion, now therefore, Her Majesty, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate and House of Commons of Canada, enacts as follows the National Planeteer Initiative. The minister must develop a national initiative to appoint planeteers who will recruit more planeteers themselves, because you can be one too, in order to save our planet, given that looting and polluting is not the way. Here's the content of the bill. The strategy must include A, a combining of the five elemental power rings, earth, fire, wind, water, and heart. B, the summoning of Captain Planet, because one, he's our hero. Two, he will bring pollution down to zero. And three, he will put asunder bad guys who like to loot and plunder. Well, I'm sorry, hold on. That's not Bill C-226. No, no. That's a synopsis and the theme song of Captain Planet and the Planeteers. I was mistaken because both this 90s kid show and the actual Bill are cartoons that are loosely based on fiction. Here's the real Bill, which is just as obscene as what I've just read you. So the real Bill C-226 is this: an act respecting the development of a national strategy to assess, prevent, and address, and here's the cartoony part, environmental racism and to advance environmental justice. So here's the preamble. Whereas the government of Canada recognizes the need to advance environmental justice across Canada and the importance of continuing to work toward eliminating racism and racial discrimination in all their forms and manifestations. Whereas a disproportionate number of people who live in environmentally hazardous areas are members of an Indigenous, racialized, or other marginalized community, the national strategy, the minister must develop a national strategy to promote efforts across Canada to advance environmental justice and to assess, prevent, and address environmental racism. Now, if you have a brain, you might be asking, like any reasonable person should ask, what's environmental justice and what is environmental racism? Those are excellent questions, but you're not going to find the answers to them in the bill, interestingly enough. I've scoured it. These are made-up cartoon terms, right? These are 90s kids TV show terms. But I was able to find definitions from greenaction.org, so you know it's reliable, right? You know that they have it right. So this is environmental racism. It is the disproportionate impact of environmental hazards on people of color. Fair enough. Environmental justice refers to those cultural norms and values, rules, regulations, behaviors, policies, and decisions to support sustainability, where all people can hold with confidence that their community and natural environment is safe and productive. In other words, it's the idea that people of various ethnic and oppressed groups are disproportionately affected by pollution and environmental issues, and this must be because of racism and systemic injustices and inequalities. That has to be the reason for these various groups being disproportionately affected by environmental issues.
And that's because that's the conclusion of race Marxism, right? The critical race theory, which is race Marxism, always comes to that conclusion. Any disparate outcomes is a sign of racism. And that's just carte blanche, that is exactly the conclusion that they come to, no matter what the disparity is, and regardless of any of the evidence that might be presented. And what we're seeing in this bill, Andrew, this absurd bill, is critical race theory, which again is race Marxism in praxis. So that's in practice. We're seeing them live out and now put forth activism bills. Right? Because critical race theory necessarily has a component to it that must be lived out. And that in the same way that Christianity says that orthodoxy, right belief, must lead therefore to orthopraxy, which is right living or right action, this religion that is a leftist, Marxist, utopian religion says that it's not only good enough to believe these insane ideological religious de fide conclusions, but then you have to put forth bills that promote and get to a racial justice and to end environmental racism as though the environment was racist.
And clearly we can see how their apologetic is not evidentialist, but it's presuppositional, right? There are presuppositions that undergird their apologetic, and Christians, I think, would be wise to learn from that. So I, in my research, is I decided to, you know, learn how it is that we need to save our planet. I found an article from The Atlantic, again, so you know they're going to be reliably representing a particular perspective. And so to show how nonsensical these ideas are, this is from The Atlantic, and this is from a few years ago. Last week, even as the Environmental Protection Agency and the Trump administration continue to plan to dismantle many of the institutions built to address these disproportionate risks, again, this is environmental racism, researchers embedded in the EPA's National Center for Environmental Assessment released a study indicating that people of color are much more likely to live near polluters and breathe polluted air. And you'll notice there, even if that is a fact, the assumption is it's because of racism. That's, it could be the only reason for it. Continues, as the study details, previous works have also been linked, so have also linked disproportionate exposure to particulate matter and America's racial geography. A 2016 study in Environment International found that long-term exposure to the pollutant is associated with racial segregation, with more highly segregated areas suffering higher levels of exposure. Now, here's their example. Hispanic people faced rates of chlorine exposure that are more than double those of white people. Chronic chlorine inhalation is known for degrading cardiac function. And there you have it. So this is what they do. They look at the actual piece of evidence, which is Hispanic people seem to have more than double the chlorine exposure rates and issues of white people. They're disproportionately affected by chlorine exposure, therefore racism. That's their assumption. Now, I'm no statistician, but a simple DuckDuckGo search for labor statistics by ethnicity in the United States yields the following. This is as of 2020. Hispanic Americans make up about 19.5% of the American population. They make up 18.5% of industrial work in mining, quarrying, and oil and gas extraction. Listen to this. Hispanic Americans make up 43.4% of occupational work in farming, fishing, and forestry. And you might say, what's the significance of that? Chlorine big time is used as a detergent and a disinfectant in agriculture and is especially in dairy farming. And this one is especially important. Hispanic Americans make up 36.7% of occupational work in building and grounds cleaning and maintenance, pool work. So it's not about racism or injustice, right? They look at the evidence and say, clearly, it's racism because of disproportionate effects on certain ethnicities. But the reality is that it's simply job choices made by various people. And what's even more frightening about this legislative Captain Planet cartoon that we're living in is how the state proposes to deal with environmental racism. And if you look at the content, basically what we need is we need to spend more money, we need to put more laws into place, and we need to get non-experts to deal with the situation and offer their solution, right? We need amendments to federal laws, the involved community groups in environmental policymaking, and compensation for individuals and communities. So we need more laws, more power, more control, bigger government, more money, more spending, and non-experts speaking in. And this is what they want, a bigger government dictating how we live and how we spend our money in order to deal with this cartoon. It's what it is. It's a cartoon.
Yeah. It's like, this is in lines with the UN 2030 sustainability goals. This is, though this, as you said, this bill deserves a clown nose, this is the type of serious proposals that are being forwarded in supranational groups like the UN that are having great impact on sovereign nations around the world that are kind of put in place, as you said, to increase the scope of government and to, because of enviro communo fascist economics, redistribute wealth in our society according to these utopian race Marxist dreams. This is religion in praxis. And it's very funny to me that the same people who would say that we as Christians ought to leave our religion out of things, ought to have a separation, not between church and state, but they say from God and state, are the very same people who are taking their faith beliefs, making it an inescapable reality that then we have to shape legislation around. And I think we just have to understand that this is in lockstep with the World Economic Forum's Great Reset. If you ever read the Great Reset COVID-19 or the Great Narrative, which is the second part of that Great Reset series, these are the type of solutions that are called for, and this is the type of worldview that's coming from this thinking. And Lord willing, we'll have Dr. Robert Murphy on our program sometime this month, hopefully later in the month, to talk a little bit about the intersection between economics and climate science, so then we could actually take an expert on this literature and learn and glean from him, and he can shed some light on how dangerous and foolish and truly absurd bills like this are. But the thing that's really concerning is this is not an absurd proposal in our parliament. This is not an absurd proposal in the UN. This is just taken for granted. And I think that is something that should concern us as Canadian citizens, that we're so far down this road that something like this, that is like virtually indistinguishable from that cartoon that you put forward, is taken as serious legislation before our parliament.
Which will demand from us, or we're going to see that there's a connection here with a lot of these bills, because some of these bills are going to call for a restructuring of work and labor in our economy, which is going to put a huge burden on some people, which is exactly what a bill like this is going to do. A bill like this is going to say, we need more of your money so that we can spend it to save our planet, because that's exactly what the Earth wants. The Earth wants to open itself up and have us just throw money at it. And that's going to make the climate cool down, and that's going to eliminate all of the natural disasters we have, is just by throwing money to the Earth. And that's what they want to do. And it is a cartoon.
Yeah. And funny enough, the people who gain to profit from that are the same people who are pushing it. So it's a little bit of a conflict of interest. Anyways, moving on. The next bill before us I want to highlight is Bill C-227, an act to amend the Canadian Election Act, and that is concerning the voting age. Just so you all know, we will link these specific bills so you can read the text and see it for yourself. We'll have all of them in the show notes, so if you want to check it out, definitely be sure to go to the show notes and you can do your own research. As a program, we don't want to be like the mainstream media telling you what to how to react, what to think. We want to be able to give you our analysis and our perspective, but then also give you the ability to do your own research. So I just wanted to highlight that as well. But this act is sponsored by Don Davies, an NDP candidate, a member of parliament from Vancouver Kingsway. And the purpose of the bill is to lower the federal voting age in Canada from 18 years of age, Andrew, to 16 years of age. So what do you think about this proposal to amend the voting age from 18 to 16? What jumps out to you about that idea?
What jumps out to me is the fact that you are taking kids who, by and large, have been the product of government schools and a type of indoctrination about the way they need to view the world, about the way they need to view policy, the way they need to view sexuality, the way they need to view money and government, and the relationship between individuals and the government. And so you've taken them, and then what you're doing now is you're taking 16-year-olds who, I mean, you have some responsible 16-year-olds who work and who drive and, you know, who are not bums, but the reality is the decisions that we are making for our elected officials, which affect the trajectory of our country, you're basically taking that decision-making power and you're putting in the hands of kids who have all their time being indoctrinated and are less likely to make an informed decision and probably haven't been exposed to a lot of alternative opinions other than what they've received in school and in the media. And so you're basically, you're setting up the play. You're creating the system and you're putting everything in place. And so you're almost guaranteeing your win. It's the same thing as offering, you know, refugees en masse lots of money and lots of safety, you're basically guaranteeing the vote. And that's kind of what's going on here.
Exactly. And it gives so much opportunity for left-leaning, progressive, primarily teachers who are indebted to student or teachers unions, which are always Marxist in orientation, to then turn their children into activists who will then go out and vote for the candidates of their choice. There's so much ripe, like this is ripe for all sorts of corruption. And it is a really cynical political move done by a progressive NDP constituent from Vancouver, very progressive city in Canada, to help aid the Progressive Caucus, which includes both the NDP, which he's a part of, and also the Liberal government, who on average would benefit from having an additional, what, it's just about, given census data, probably about a million or so more people added to voter registrations. And this is, like you said, these primarily are kids who, because of a lot of these union laws and labor laws, who primarily don't work anymore because it's so onerous to for businesses to hire kids who are 15, 16. And because of minimum wage laws that have so artificially raised the price of labor in our marketplace, it has really outstripped the actual production of low-skilled workers like teens who don't have a lot of responsibility, have a lot of work experience. We're giving people who can't a lot of times drive, right? Who can't, you know, smoke or drink or make any of these important decisions that we say should be and rightfully are not for kids who are 16 to be making. We're now saying that these people who have very little at stake in our civic life, who are not, you know, generally taxpayers, who don't have much to do, they're not property owners, they don't have much to do in our civic life, we're giving them a vote that is equal to those people who are producers, who are business owners, who have much at stake, who are property owners. And I just think it really highlights a lot of the wisdom in the founders of the United States of America and Canada in when they were instituting the right to enfranchisement, that it wasn't broad and universal, because they understood that people, in order to cast their vote in a representative system, ought to have something at stake in civic life. They ought to have a controlling interest only if they are engaged in public life in a substantial way. And a lot of people have said that those laws were put into place because of racism, but it didn't really matter what race you are. It was actually put into place that just like a board would do to be a member of any institution, be a part of that institution. You have to be a stakeholder in that institution or a shareholder in that institution. You have to bring something to the table. That's the same logic that went into enfranchisement, but now we've lowered the bar so much that anybody is involved, including children who are in grade 10, right? I didn't know anything about electoral politics when I was in grade 10. I didn't know my arse from my elbow, to put it frankly, when I was that young. Yet because of democracy, so-called, and for the sake of future leaders, we have to lower the voting age, thus diluting your vote in federal elections, Andrew.
And there are connection pieces here, right? Like there's going to be a particular piece of legislation you're going to be highlighting in a bit that ties into this very much. And what I'm getting at is, if you look at this bill on the heels of the last 2 years, so I don't know about yourself, but for me, the segment of the population that I have seen that is by far the most compliant with masks would be teens and young adults. And they've been beaten down over the last 2 years. I mean, people in the 13 to 18, you know, let's focus on the 16 to 18 range, because that's where they want to lower the voting age. These kids have been devastated, right? They've lost so much. We've seen huge spikes in mental disorders and in eating disorders and in suicide attempts. And so we've seen a segment of the population that has been devastated. And what have they learned over the last 2 years? If they comply, if they do what the government tells them, if they play by the rules, everything gets to go back to normal. They get to see their friends, they get to see their family, they get to go to prom, they get to graduate. And so we have beaten down on a segment of the population, and we've made them so compliant, so reliant on the state, and now you're going to give them the right and the ability to vote. What do you think they're going to do? They're going to further whatever agenda has been beating them down like a bat for the last 2 years. And so you've created this cohort of people that are now ripe for whatever you want them to do and however you want them to vote. And so we can't miss that these are not just isolated things. It's not just, oh, this is a good bit of legislation. Oh, this is a neat bill. There are things that connect all of this. Right? There's clearly something more insidious at work than just, we think 16-year-olds should vote. We think a very compliant segment of the population that we have devastated, that now we're going to offer an allowance to stay at home and do nothing. Oh, and by the way, we've taught them they have to comply to us to be safe and happy. Well, of course they're going to vote the way you want them to vote and further an agenda, not actually do what's best for the country.
Yes, absolutely. And I just, before moving on, Andrew, I want to highlight another bill by Don Davies, NDP of Vancouver. Talk about male privilege. How does he have two bills up here? I mean, that's crazy. That's wild. Anyways, he's also proposed Bill C-254. And one of our writers highlighted the importance of this bill, and we're not going to cover it in depth, but I just want to talk about it, what it would do. And essentially, what this bill would do is it's an enactment amends the Parliament of Canada Act to provide that a member's seat in the House of Commons is vacated and a by-election called for that seat if the member having been elected to the House as a member of a registered party or as an independent changes parties or becomes a member of a different party. So what is this going to do in our electoral system? Well, instead of these members of parliament representing the people of their riding, of their district, they are now members that represent a political point of view of the party that they hold to. So instead of being accountable to the people that they represent, they're most accountable to the people that lead their parties. And so this is blatantly anti-democratic. This is blatantly making politics in Canada even more heavily reliant on the power of parties to caucus together and stay together. And it totally squashes dissident voices, because if you speak out against your party in Canada, it's very likely that the leader can just kick you, basically unilaterally caucus, get a bunch of his troops together, kick you out of the party, and then all of a sudden you have to go up for immediate by-election, which you're going to have to pay for. And what is this going to do? It's going to squash any dissidents within any party from speaking out against a political party platform. It totally kills political independent voices in our society. And I don't understand for a second how this actually improves democracy. So I love to just juxtapose what's going to be said by the same man, Don Davies. We need to lower the age of voting for democracy, but at the same time, we're going to ruin democracy by killing dissenting voices. I think it's absurd. Do you have any comments before we move on, Andrew?
Well, it makes sense, because by lowering the voting age, like I said, the group of people that now become eligible voters are not the group of people who are dissenting. They are the compliant people, right? We saw this when the War Measures Act was brought into being. We saw at least one liberal who stood out and said, listen, this is unconstitutional. And then the moment the concern, right, the vote of confidence was teased, now you had liberal people saying, you had liberal members saying, well, if this doesn't pass, then there's a chance that I could also lose my seat. I could be voted out. The premier, the prime minister could be voted out. And so it's you use this pressure to force compliance. We're going to force you to be compliant. We're going to force you to toe the line. You're going to do what we want. And it crushes any kind of democratic process. And so, of course, crushing the democratic process fits right in line with giving the vote to people whose spirits have also been crushed and who you know are going to be very compliant. They're going to do, right, 16, 18-year-olds are going to do exactly what you want them to do, which is precisely the kind of flex on other members of the of caucuses you've been flexing because you just get them to do what you want. So it's more the same. These things are all connected.
Yeah, democracy to these leftist ideologues is majoritarianism. And that's what really connects these bills. So when they're using that term democracy, don't think of it as anything that pertains to our actual constitutional monarchy or something like a representative republic down south. It's not what they mean. They are playing with language, and you see it coming out in the bills that they're putting forward. Andrew, you have another bill that you want to talk about.
Yes, I do. And we have called this the Most Petty Bill Award, and it goes to Bill S-220. And so this was sponsored by Claude Carignan. He's a conservative in Quebec. And so the purpose is an act to amend the Language Skills Act pertaining to the Governor General. This is the analysis. The act would mandate that the Governor General would have to be able to speak French. Has to be able to speak French. Now, this bill was brought before the Senate specifically in response to the appointment of Mary Simon, who was appointed by Trudeau pretty much because she was an Aboriginal female, right? She ticked a few of the intersectional boxes, and we know that our Prime Minister was very clear that he wants his, not only does he want his cabinet 50-50, but he wants diversity, inclusion, and equity to be a part of his platform and how he runs. So this is why she was appointed. Now, this highlights, or it showcases the madness of identity politics when you base them on this intersectional grid and having people check the various boxes. Because she was appointed specifically based on her race and her sex because she's an Aboriginal female. And so what some people would say is a racist and sexist act, it's still not good enough because she also doesn't speak French. So still not quite enough intersectional markers for her. She also needs to be bilingual or trilingual depending on how many languages that we learn. And so if we continue down this road, if we continue to elevate people who check more and more boxes on this intersectional grid, right, this matrix, this rubric of people who are elevated and voices that must be given platforms, eventually we're going to get to the point where you can only have left-handed, transgendered, pansexual, non-binary, mixed race or ethnically ambiguous linguophiles with disabilities. They cannot be able-bodied because that's ableism. They're the only ones that are going to be able to hold public office. And a regular old white straight Christian guy will have no place because he is at the top of the oppressor class. That's where we're going.
I mean, wonderful analysis. And it does point to the absurdity of identity politics. And I just want to jump in here and then we'll move on to the last bill that we want to touch on. I am concerned about how much this has just leaked its way into the warp and woof of our political conversation. Because when I hear people talking about how Leslyn Lewis would be the greatest candidate that the Conservatives could put forward, why is that a lot of people talk about? I mean, she has a great pro-life voting record. She hasn't been in Parliament very long. She has strong pro-life positions. There's a lot to like. She's very educated. She's not the best politician in the world. But what really people want to point to is the fact that she's a thumb in the nose of these liberals because she checks a lot of intersectional boxes, right? But that concerns me that in order to get back at people that we're also going to be racists and sexist, I don't think as principled conservatives, as committed Christians, that ought to be the way that we think of things. Now, I think there's, like I said, there's a lot to like about Leslyn. some stuff that I wouldn't be as happy with. But we should let her stand on her own merits, not on identity politics. And we got to be careful not to play the devil's games when it comes to politics. We need to take principled stands and call out this evil for what it is. It's sexism. It's racism. And the only way that it's not is if you adopt this race Marxism, critical race theory perspective of the world. And that's the very thing that we're trying to do this podcast, to make sure people don't go down that road, to offer people a different perspective on this stuff. So that's kind of my last comments before we move on to, like I said, the last bill that we have here. So there's two bills that are working in conjunction with one another. One sponsored by the Senate, which is S-233, and then another bill, C-223, and it's all pertaining to guaranteed livable basic income, or what most people know as universal basic income. And that was put forward in the Senate by Senator Kim Pate. She's from Ontario. She's an independent senator. A lot of those independent senators are wild progressives, just to put that out there. And Leah Gazan, who's the NDP MP from actually my riding here in Winnipeg Center.
She's in your backyard.
She's in my backyard. Yes. In the west end of Winnipeg. And if you know the neighborhood, I digress. What this bill attempts to put forward is it attempts to ensure that the Minister of Finance would have to come up with a framework and a proposal for the implementation of a universal basic income in Canada, which would mean that it would guarantee a livable so-called income to anybody 17 years or older in Canada. So that would essentially make everybody 17 and older wards of the state. This is supposedly to amend and reform and revolutionize our current welfare state. It's argued that it would be more cost-effective and efficient way of distributing or redistributing the wealth in our state through the administrative welfare state. And it's important to know that it's also guaranteed to non-citizens. So non-Canadian citizens, like temporary workers, permanent residents who don't have citizen status, and also refugees. So we're extending the welfare state to universally apply to everybody over 17, including non-citizens of this country. And it must be added that part of the bill, this is specifically called for in the framework, is that there would be no criteria or threshold of participation. So when we're talking about universality, we're talking about this applies to anybody regardless of what they want to do, whether they're going to school, whether trying to be productive or unproductive. It does not matter at all. And what I'm really concerned of, and you can comment on this, Andrew, is that this is not only a bill detached from any immutable economic principles, as progressives like to do. They're totally detached from reality and living life according to their utopian dreams, but it would actually detach labor from income. So doing work gets you paid. So providing a service to people gets you paid. It would totally decouple those. And then it would create essentially two classes of citizens. It would, one, create a producer class, which would be taxed even more heavily to pay for this system. And then it would create a creative consumer class of people who are living high off the hog. They're not doing anything, yet they are getting paid to live. And just finally, it would be dependent upon where you live in Canada based off of the supposed livable income in your area. So Ontario, you would obviously get a lot more, Andrew, than I would here in Manitoba based on cost of living. But maybe you could touch on that before I get into some of the more in-depth analysis of this bill.
Well, I think the best part of that is that I'll be getting more than you because I'm in Ontario. Yeah. That really is the best part of it. And so we have to see the threads here, right? We have to see the threads, and we can't see... This has been something that Christians and conservative-minded people have been guilty of, most especially in the last 2 years. We've been very reactionary. Something has happened. We respond. We're not thinking a couple steps ahead. We're not seeing the bigger picture here. We're not seeing the game at play. We're just seeing the individual plays in the game, and we're responding to them. And so we need to see that there's a thread here. And we've basically told people in the last 2 years that our elected officials can not only be our God, but they can also be our dad. And some of the language that they use is they want to be our dad. So if you can't work, that's okay. We'll give you an allowance. You know, here's certain people you can't see. You can't see this person. You can't do this activity. You can't go out past this time. You can't go here. You're not allowed to travel to this place without this. Oh, make sure you wear your helmet. Like, our civil government wants to be our dad. They want to be our father. And what we've created in the last 2 years, and this goes back to the voting age bill, this goes back to a lot of the legislation, we have created a very, very compliant population that will rely more heavily than before on the civil government to take care of it, to provide for it, to protect it. And what we've also done, and you and I were talking about this, that what we saw during the last 2 years with the CERB, with the COVID relief, with the crushing of businesses, those were basically the test run for this. Like that was the threshold to get us through to the universal basic income. Because what our government saw was that you can take people's jobs, you can take their businesses, you can force them to stay at home, and you can say to them, but we'll pay you for it. And so it isn't just about providing money. What you're doing is you're not only creating a compliant people, but you're actually crushing independence. You're crushing an entrepreneurial spirit. You're actually taking away from people the desire to work and be creative and drive, which, by the way, are creational norms. We have been made to create, to produce, to work, to do something, to not be idle. You know, the Bible talks a lot about idleness. And some people might say, oh, you know, work and stuff in the Old Testament. Fine, you're going to play that game. The Apostle Paul is clear in 2 Thessalonians. In fact, depending on the Bible you have, a little heading there in chapter 3 is warning against idleness. And his words are clear, right? This is what we say. We give you this command. This is verse 10. If anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. Period. Full stop. And the warning is to live a life of idleness where you're not working, you're not producing, you're not contributing, you're just feeding off of the government teat is dangerous. And it's dangerous because that's not how we've been built. And so all this, the creating a compliant, dependent, not creative, not initiating, not entrepreneurial type of population where people that take risks and start businesses get them taken away from them, this will hugely affect the face of our country. This is not just an economic thing. I mean, this is a deep spiritual, emotional, psychological thing. We are reshaping how people think and how they work and what they do with their hands and with their minds. I mean, we are reshaping our population to think about the government as being sole provider, protector, and it's dangerous. And it's like you said, it's in line with a globalist agenda that squashes not only human individuality and human responsibility, but also sovereign nations and their individuality. And so these are all connected. There are threads that are woven throughout this that should alarm us. It's not just one thing. It's a big thing. There's many things together.
Yeah, and it's totally contra how the kingdom of God should operate, right? When we look at chapter 20, verses 25 and following, The Lord Jesus makes this comment in passing, and it really, really is a powerful comment. And he just picks up on something that we need to understand. And he says, but Jesus called to them, talking about their disciples who are arguing about who's going to be the best in heaven. He says this, and that's primarily when we hear sermons talk about this passage, we talk about it from, look at these silly disciples. They're talking about who's going to be the best in the kingdom of heaven. Don't you know at the foot of the cross that all the ground is level? It's silliness. We rightfully talk about their foolishness and their haughtiness in this. But Jesus says this, and it's very clever. He says, you know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It shall not be so among you, but whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be your slave, even as the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And what he's saying there is the Gentiles set themselves up as your gods, as your providers. They set themselves as a god of all providence for their own well-being, and they use that to lord it over you. But in the kingdom of heaven, that's not how the economy should work. Those who should get paid, who should be held in honor, ought to be the servants of many. They ought to lay down their lives to provide for others. This is an economy that is totally counter to anything that we see in Scripture. And we shouldn't be surprised, because it's coming from a world and life view that is totally and utterly at every turn of counterfeit apostate faith that hates the Lord of Scripture and who is trying to pervert how people live in the world that he's created, and it is ultimately doomed to fail. Why? Because even in a state like Finland that is really progressive, they tried to implement this UBI structure through an experiment, and this is the amazing outcome. So this is from an article called Basic Income or a Single Tapering Rule, Incentives, Inclusiveness, and Affordability Compared for the Case of Finland. And it's published by a bunch of economists in Finland concerning the UBI program that they privately took on this. It wasn't government sponsored, but they tried to institute this UBI. And what the paper comes up with is, it's estimated that the replacement of our current welfare state, the current social benefit system, by the UBI in Finland would either be too expensive or would mean insufficient benefits for the most deprived, consequently an increase in the share of people below the poverty line from, this is according to the study, 11.5 to 14%. That's the detrimental effect that this had in a small test in Finland. And we know it in our communities. I live in Manitoba. High population, percentage of the population, are Aboriginals, who are and have been wards of the state for time immemorial, for basically as long as Canada's existed under the Indian Act. And has that ever led to them flourishing as a people? No. It's actually, I was talking to my mom about this, and she's done a lot of work within Aboriginal organizations. She's a social worker. And isn't it stark how you can look down south to our southern border, and you can see so many more influential and wealthy politicians, athletes, all sorts of, across all spectrums of African American people who were actually enslaved in their country and actually by law segregated as a people. And so our Aboriginal communities here in the north didn't experience that type of slavery and subjugation. Now, in some cases, it was bad what happened. But my point is this. Our welfare state, creating Aboriginals, Indigenous people, as wards of the state, has been so detrimental to the character of people in that situation that even if they didn't succumb to some of those terrible social pressures like we see in the African American community to our south, it has even led to worse outcomes. That's how bad being a ward of the state is. It's totally contra-creational, as you talk about. It's totally against the fact that we are human beings created in God's image, and as a part of that image, we're made, the entire warp and woof of the life of human beings is to work and to worship. That's the entire warp and woof of human beings. That's our entire purpose. And if the government is trying to take away both of those things, as we've seen through this reflexive scandemic, what we're seeing is, not surprisingly, horrible mental health outcomes and horrible financial outcomes and all sorts of, you know, terrible outcomes that are going to come from a bill like this. And this is all done in the name of compassion, but it's not compassionate. Andrew, do you have anything to say on this bill and kind of to wrap things up as we, you know, look more broadly at all these bills that we've covered on today's program?
I think that as believers, as those who understand that God's word indeed is true and authoritative, and we believe that he has designed not only this world, but human beings, that his creational norms and his creational designs are true, and that ultimately our lives need to be lined up with his design. Part of what we need to see here is we need to see that this compliance, laziness, apathy, the squashing of individuality, the squashing of initiative and working hard, and providing what this is doing is, this is deteriorating what it means to be a human, right? You touched on this, and it's against creational norms, but this is a direct attack on what it means to be human and what it means to be made in God's image. I mean, being made in God's image means a few different things. It means that we share in some of his attributes, right? But it also means that we are supposed to image him. We're supposed to represent him to the world. And our God is creative. He makes, he sustains, right? The picture, it's not as if he's breaking a sweat, but he's working on those 6 days as he's bringing creation out of nothing. And so to be like him, to line our lives up with him, means that as believers, what we need to do, and especially as we think about our children, as we think about younger people around us, is we need to instill in them that it's not just about a good Western work ethic, but it is biblical, it is deeply spiritual to say to them, you need to be responsible. You need to take your own life. You need to work hard. You need to do something. You need to create. You can't just stay at home till you're 35 and have your parents pay your way and then do your laundry and your mom makes sure she folds your bed just the way that you like. Nah, that's not going to fly. You have to work hard. You have to take initiative. You have to be creative. You have to be entrepreneurial. You actually have to go and work and do and sweat. This is a biblical thing. This is a spiritual thing. And so we need to encourage our people not to. We need to encourage one another to see that simply sitting back and complying and doing what you're told, and we'll give you the money and we'll protect you and we'll provide for you, and having the civil government as our father or as our God, destroys the image of God in us, and it damages creation significantly. I mean, like you said, we've seen the increase in alcoholism and substance abuse and domestic disorder, domestic abuse and suicides and suicide attempts. This isn't just because people are afraid of a virus, and this isn't just because people can't work. It's because you have stripped from people, and you know, specifically men, you've stripped from them what it means to be a man. Right, which is go out, provide, take initiative, work hard, make something, and you've taken that away from them. You've robbed them of their very humanity, and so obviously they're going to plunge into despair. Right, we saw this at the trucker convoy. I saw this when I was in Ottawa. People in despair, and part of the reason why you had such a strong response, I believe, from our elected officials, is because they were hoping for compliance, and they were hoping for people to just lie down and take it. And what they saw was people saying, no, that's not going to happen. That's not what it means to be Canadian. That's not what it means to be human. And so we need to keep pushing that. We need to keep pressing into that this is how God has designed us to be. This is how he's designed his world to operate. And we're not just going to settle for this UBI. We're not going to settle for your protection and your provision. The Lord tells us how to operate. The Lord will take care of us.
So important, man. Our discussion today has even come down to anthropology. I love it. But this is really what politics, you know, it comes down to a conflict of visions. And I think that's what we're trying to highlight in highlighting these bills, is there's a conflict of visions here. You and I are talking about believing in Imago Dei, image of God, immutable fact that all people, regardless of gender or race, sex, whatever you have it, they're made in the image of God and in his likeness. And the progressives don't believe that at all. They believe human beings are infinitely malleable and can be constructed or reconstructed in whatever ways you want, according to whatever utopian dreams that you have. And Thomas Sowell has a book called Conflict of Visions, which, you know, it talks about this. But this is really important for us to understand, is all of these discussions get down to the basic presuppositions of the people having these. And we have to be able to get down to that ground floor to have the discussions on that level if we're actually going to lay out a civilization that can be fruitful, that can be sustainable, and can ultimately be God glorifying. So that's why the Liberty Coalition exists. That's why this program, the Liberty Dispatch, exists, is to have these conversations at that level of worldview, so we can help you think through these issues, think through these pieces of legislation from a conservative Christian perspective that believes in innate immutability of human nature, that we're designed in God's image, that there are economic laws, laws of reality that apply to the things that we do and the way that we live, not only as individuals, but corporately as well. And that's why we exist. So if you want to learn more about us, go over to libertycoalition.com and you can check out all things that we have going on over there. If you're checking us out at our Rumble channel, don't forget to subscribe. Please share our content wherever you're getting us, whether it's on podcast catchers like Spotify, Apple Play, YouTube, whatever you're on, share it with other people, because these are conversations that, as Canadians, if we want to get back our freedoms, we have to do hard thinking like this. So we really hope you enjoyed the program. We hope that you didn't miss too much Mike's crazy analogies that oftentimes don't make sense, but give a lot of color to the way things go. I don't really think like that. I don't know about you, Andrew. You provided levity, so we can be thankful of that. But Andrew, just final word over to you to wrap things up.
Yeah, these are important discussions, right? And we do need to think deeply about these things. You're right, that we need to be critical thinking, and we need to understand what's going on. We need to not see these bills and see what's happening in our country as mere isolated events, and not see them as merely little dots, and react to them. That's part of why we're in this situation, is because we've been reacting merely to what's in front of us. What we need to do is we need to understand that there is a divine order to creation. There is a way that God has put things together. And there is a false religion, a false creation that's pressing against that. We need to see it for what it is, and we need to push back against it with truth for our liberties, for our freedoms, and ultimately for the glory of God as he has designed this world to be.
Absolutely, brother. We got to avoid our modern day Tower of Babel. All right. Thank you, everybody, so much for tuning in. And we're glad that you did it. Again, please share, like, subscribe, rate, and review. Godspeed, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to Liberty Dispatch, a united front to restore liberty and justice in Canada. Please subscribe to our podcast and Rumble channel, as well as visit our website at www.libertycoalitioncanada.com.